When I say the Amelia Earhart Fred Noonan case is a monster, you know I'm telling the truth. In 2017, I began my journey into this case publicly. And if there's one thing I discovered right away, it's that this case, the one we've been covering for well over 100 episodes now, it's full of misinformation. It's gotten so bad that it becomes overwhelming when you start to look at it. And if you choose to answer the why to that question, you might find that we're all partially to blame for where this case currently stands. So how do we shift the narrative? Where in the world do we begin to dismantle even one of these theories? As it turns out, the answer to that question for me came a couple of months ago when one of our listeners, Becky Ott, posted a photo in our Facebook discussion group for Vanished. The photo was taken outside the St. Charles, Missouri County Library, and it was of a sign that read "Discover the Past, Amelia Earhart, Myth and Memory." The presenter that night is also tonight's guest. I believed in synergy all my life, but I can't explain how it works. It just does. And it almost always occurs at just the right moment, doesn't it? Thanks to Becky's post and her follow-up with more information, I was able to connect with a guest that's making her Chasing Earhart debut right now. And she's about to pull the linchpin on everything you thought you knew about the Amelia Earhart case. You're not ready for this, but we're going to give it to you anyway. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. By way of St. Louis, Missouri, this is Amy Lutz. And all right, live at last. Amy, welcome to the show. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So a couple of things I want to do just right out of the gate here tonight. Check the show's notes for people that are listening to this. There's going to be an awful lot of information in there. This is a conversation that, you know, is going to cover a pretty insane amount of information in the little bit of time that we have. But the show notes will allow you to go back over everything yourself, maybe as you listen along, all that jazz. You know the drill for people that listen to the show. Amelia Earhart, Myth and Memory is the title of both of our primary sources here in our discussion tonight. The first source is, of course, your thesis, and the second is the presentation that is based off of that thesis, sort of an expansion, if you will. Now, folks, you'd think it might be true that the work you're doing on Amelia Earhart is like the most impressive stuff you're doing, but you'd be wrong. Please tell our audience a little bit about your education and your professional background as we start.
Sure. Absolutely. Thanks again for having me on. So I am a historian by trade. I have an undergraduate and a master's degree in history from a couple of universities here in St. Louis, Missouri. And my professional history is actually I'm in marketing and communications, which surprisingly ends up coming in handy as someone who's a bit of an expert on propaganda and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I currently am actually at the St. Louis Kaplan Feldman Holocaust Museum in St. Louis, Missouri. And so in addition to my historical work on Amelia Earhart, particularly on the mythology around her, the historiography around Amelia Earhart, I also know quite a bit about the Holocaust and the history of the Holocaust as well. And so, yes, I wrote this graduate thesis, which was published in 2020. I should also add, and forgive me if I'm preempting you here, I grew up just in Kansas.
Yes, we're getting there, but go for it.
You know, I moved there actually when I was 8. My dad was born there, but moved there when I was 8 years old, which is actually kind of the reverse of Amelia Earhart. She was there for about the first 8 years and then left. And I showed up at age 8 many years later. Yeah. And my legal name is actually Amelia, which is very interesting being a middle schooler in Atchison, Kansas. Yeah. Amelia, first place being named Amelia.
Right.
So that was in a way kind of how I fell into this topic. Yeah. You know, I remember I was taking a couple graduate school classes and I just had these thoughts of, I wonder where, you know, these ideas came from about what happened to her. And that just moment of curiosity just dove me into it. And here I am.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously you're very affected by Earhart's life and the disappearance side of things. Can you remember how you first heard about her? Obviously you're named after her. It's your namesake. Mm-hmm. Can you remember like when you first started hearing about her, I guess from a pop culture standpoint, or maybe just a public standpoint in education?
Yeah. You know, I will say, I'm actually not sure if I am named after her. I suspect there was an inspiration there because my dad was born in Atchison and it's hard to get away from it. I think I probably really, she came into my understanding around the time I moved to Atchison when I was second or third grade. You know, the thing about living in a town that, you know, has a famous resident, especially a small town, is that you can't get away from it. You know, I went to the Amelia Earhart Birthplace Museum probably every year during school. We went to the Amelia Earhart Festival, which I know you've been in. I was terrified of fireworks. So that's a big thing I remember about her. I grew up at first having a real, I don't know if kinship is the right thing, but you know, I really admired Amelia Earhart for her, you know, just being a woman who accomplished something at a time when it was very difficult for women to accomplish what she did. And it was always very sad to me that she disappeared, that she disappeared relatively young, that we didn't know what happened to her. I will say though, I went in a bit of a, I had a bit of a cycle with Amelia Earhart, because the thing about, again, living in Atchison is that you can't get away from her. Everything is named after her, and it got to a point where, look, I'm being called Amelia Earhart by my middle school classmates who think it's hilarious, and then I'm hearing about it all the time. So at one point, I was like, ah, I've had enough. But I think getting some distance and going to undergraduate and grad school out of state helped, and really actually kind of brought me back into this subject. And what I think is very interesting is I've actually kind of grown to love her and her story through my research, and have kind of circled back to where I started.
All right. Well, listen, folks, there are an awful lot of people that feel that what we'll be discussing tonight, at least the overall theory, isn't even theory. It's truth. It's the truth at last, right? You know, I admire the passion that some of these folks fight for, you know, when it comes to this theory, or have when it comes to this theory, rather. It's very, very controversial in nature, kind of was birthed out of controversy, and it continues to be so. But when We Did Vanished and Jen got to cross-examine some of the experts that appeared on the show, it becomes very, very shaky. And there's evidence of holes, certainly. You know, there's also a much bigger picture here. You know, there's one that's rampant with information, which you happen to specialize in. So I guess to start tonight, to really start tonight, at what point do you look at all of this and think something's kind of weird here?
It's interesting because, you know, I won't dive too much into my childhood, but I remember being told, and not being told, but hearing Amelia Earhart was shot down by the Japanese. She was captured by the Japanese. That was just something that people had told me. My mother told me, and not that my mother believed it, but said, oh, some people believe this. And it was just always there. And like I said, you know, Amelia Earhart was a figure that I kind of, I wouldn't say stepped away from, but didn't do too much until I got to grad school. And I gotta tell you, I just had this moment. I was taking a class in grad school, quite literally called The History of Fake News. Very convenient. And this is how I fell backward into this study. And I was standing in my kitchen, and I just had a moment. I wonder where that came from. You know, that I made this connection in my head that Earhart disappeared in 1937, and that World War II began not too long after that. The United States enters the war, and I just remember sitting there and thinking, I wonder if there's a connection. And you know, like a good historian, we'll dive deeper into it. I had a feeling of where it was going to go, but I didn't want to jump in and be led to it. You know, one of the things, I am an expert in this kind of thing, on how confirmation bias works and all that kind of stuff. But what I found was, once I dove into it and immersed myself in the history, I think my gut instinct, that really was coming from being a historian and understanding that time period, was really pointing to something, that my gut instinct was revealing something I think was true, that there were some questions about when this theory arose and how that aligned with public consciousness and understanding at the time.
Well, we're going to jump around the case a little bit here tonight, because I think anybody who's heard, you know, if you're still listening to this show, 100 and whatever episodes in that we are now, then obviously you're pretty familiar, at least foundationally, with what we're going to talk about. But we'll spend a lot of time tonight discussing the whys and the why nots. Let me just ask you, I guess, bluntly here as we go, where on the scale do you place the Japanese capture theory in terms of likelihood and probability? Can we start with that?
Sure. I mean, so look, on one hand, I can't prove a negative. I can't prove that it never happened. And I will also say that my goal was not, when I jumped into this, to disprove anything. Again, because I can't. But as you'll see in a second, you'll see where I land on this. Because I know where it came from, and because I know that it was born not out of facts, but out of, in some cases, fear, propaganda, wartime communication, I would put it pretty firmly on the unlikely end of the spectrum.
Okay. Well, just, for the record, we want to make sure that people
Yep.
know kind of where we're going with this tonight. Because we've played devil's advocate on the show, that's kind of what we do, and
Sure.
I think it's important. Everything should have a magnifying glass, on it at some point, and you kind of have to with a case this big. So why do you think the theory gains so much traction so many years after the disappearance? Like, they bring up an excellent point. Why not right away?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? And don't get me wrong, obviously there was a lot of global attention on what happened to Amelia Earhart in 1937. And I'm sure you know this and you've talked about this, but the celebrity of aviators at the time was
Immense.
immense. They were the celebrities of celebrities. And so to have one disappear so dramatically, it wouldn't have surprised me from a counterfactual standpoint if all these theories came up. But what you actually see is in 1937, there's a lot of reporting, there's a lot of speculation on what happened. It actually looks a lot like, if you remember the Malaysian Airlines flight that went down, there was a lot of theorizing online, don't get me wrong. But a lot of the discussion at that time was, all right, how long can this plane stay in the air? How long can this plane float? Where would it have gone? It's actually pretty similar in 1937. Where there's speculating, but it's like, all right, where was she? Where, so that's kind of the message, the general discussion you get. I looked through every publication that I could find, newspaper, magazine, trying to almost disprove myself, trying to find some report about, oh, you know what? Did the Japanese have something to do with this? And the only thing I found in 1937 is there are plenty of newspaper reports reporting, in many cases quite positively, that Japan has helped the search for Amelia Earhart. Great Britain and Japan participated in the naval search,
That's right.
and I couldn't find anything. So you really start to see what I call the, and I use a big umbrella when I say Japanese capture. I mean anything that kind of falls, I mean anything
I
that falls
agree.
under that.
I agree.
You really see that pop up in very early 1942. Now let's put ourselves in time here. December 7th, 1941, of course, is Pearl Harbor. The United States enters the war very quickly. If you look at Gallup polls from the time, and this will become relevant later, it's nearly 100% of people are supportive of entering this war. So this is a really, really big push. And understandably, I mean, we had a military base attacked, people died, it was frightening. And so but then shortly after, it really starts with the Flight for Freedom story. So Flight for Freedom, it didn't come out for a couple years after that, but it is a film that is very much about Amelia Earhart. Her name is not in it, but it's a film from 1943 in which an aviator, Tony Carter, is trying to circumnavigate the globe, very similar to Amelia Earhart. She's approached by the government who says, hey, you're going to
A
be going
big
over
job.
some Japanese mandated islands. You want to take a look at those? And she's like, sure. So she's a spy. Very exciting. What's really interesting is that some of the early press, the film doesn't premiere until 1943, but the early press for that film, it was initially called Stand By to Die. It had, Rosalind Russell attached to it. The early press reports it as, oh, this is a weird story. This is a weird story. Did this, just kind of poking it as fictional. That changes over time. But what you find is in early 1943, there's these early reports of just about this new film coming out. It happens. Hollywood reports films coming out. So you see all these series of stories calling this, in newspapers calling this like a weird story. And then very quickly, within a few months, and there's a bunch of other incidents we can talk about related to this that come up, you start seeing newspaper and magazine reports saying, was Amelia Earhart a spy? Was she downed by the Japanese separately from Flight for Freedom? If you look at the timeline, it comes very much on the heels of when this theory became really widespread in the public. After this first few months of 1942, you start to see it kind of take a life of its own.
And then you mentioned the political climate of the time playing a role in really the public being so ready to jump on this when it becomes public. I guess, is that all part of the plan?
I mean, I hate to say there was a plan. I don't think any of this was intentional, but I'm glad you brought that up because I'll kind of circulate back a little bit in centering us in the context of the propaganda of the time. In any wartime, every side is going to use propaganda. This is the fact of wartime
There
they're
it
going to
is.
use. Positive and negative propaganda. And I don't mean that by good and bad. I mean positive in that they're going to build up their own side and make themselves seem really good. And they're going to attack the people they perceive as, or the people who are their enemies. So
Sure.
you have the positive and negative. And the interesting thing, this is a vast summary of a pretty big topic, but the interesting thing about wartime propaganda after the United States enters the war is that you see a distinct difference between anti-German propaganda and anti-Japanese propaganda. There's some things about Italy and so, but really Germany and Japan are the big ones. And so when it comes to Germany, a lot of the messaging that you see within propaganda that is picked up in public culture and consciousness, this isn't just government directed. I mean, obviously that's building the environment, but this propaganda wouldn't be successful if it didn't have fertile ground. So we have both sides of it. So the anti-German propaganda really focused on the Nazis. It said, the Nazi party, and they were. The Nazi parties were the evil bad guys. They were the ones running through Europe. But there were good Germans, right? That there this is what the propaganda said, that there were good Germans who were there who were just being victimized by the Nazis. And it's the Nazis. It's really focused on a specific political party and specific people. Anti-Japanese propaganda is something else entirely. Anti-Japanese propaganda becomes deeply, deeply racial. Any sort of depiction, whether it's in film, posters, magazines, whatever, depicting the Japanese often depicts all Japanese as inherently evil. There's kind of the gross stereotypes as being sneaky, quote unquote, or untrustworthy. And don't get me wrong, the Japanese military was doing really awful things, particularly to the Chinese. But that's a different thing than saying racially they're all one thing.
You're right.
I picked some really gross stuff up when I was doing the research of comparing the Japanese to animals, saying that they're inherently evil. It's no surprise, unfortunately, that the United States ends up interning or incarcerating thousands and thousands of Japanese
Japanese,
Americans. And so this is the environment in which this theory comes to the forefront. And that is the reason why you don't really see it in 1937. Now, you've got a bubbling, what we call the Yellow Scare, which is a little questionable title in hindsight, fears of the imperial expansion, primarily of Japan in the Pacific. You see that in the 30s, but it's not as big as it is after Pearl Harbor. And so people just make this natural connection in their heads, right? And honestly, it makes sense. At a basic level, it makes sense. We were attacked by the Japanese. They're terrifying. We're at war with them. Of course, they had something to do with Amelia Earhart. I mean, it makes a logical sense. I mean, that's the thing about conspiracy theories is that the reason they work is because, number one, that's how our brains are patterned. Our brains like patterns. We like making connections. And also, we don't like the unknown. And so Amelia Earhart having disappeared mysteriously, I mean, this is the same with Anastasia, with, people who've
D.B.
disappeared
Cooper is a big
mysteriously.
one.
There's another one. So there's all these theories. So you're already going to have fertile ground with the unknown of it, people wanting to know what happened. And then suddenly Japan shows up. And even subconsciously, I think a lot of people who jump onto this at the time just think it makes sense. Of course, it makes sense. They're the bad guys. They had something to do with it. So because of the environment that's starting to occur in late 41 and 42, it became a fertile ground for this theory to blossom.
Well, and it's a great segue. I love segues. And one of my favorite aspects of Japanese capture is Tokyo Rose. And we haven't really given it its proper due, really, on the show. So we'd like to do that. I'd like to rectify that now. Can you just give everyone a snapshot of what Tokyo Rose was, is, and what it represented? And then we'll get into it.
So Tokyo Rose, it's and in fact it's one of those elements that really doesn't have a lot of volume in the Japanese capture world. It's pretty
It
small.
is.
Tokyo Rose was an actual woman. She did exist. She was an English-speaking woman who was forced, and Tokyo Rose was the allied term for her. And I've got her name. I can never pronounce it well. It's Eva Toguri Donquino was the woman who was Tokyo Rose. And what she was on broadcasts, on radio broadcasts, as a propaganda tool for the Japanese, as part of Japanese warfare. And she was speaking on behalf of the Japanese, speaking against the Allies. And there was supposed to be this real, again, I hate to say psychological warfare again, but that's exactly what it is. It's meant to demoralize the Allies in that you're emphasizing the difficulties that the Allies are having in the military. Hearing an English-speaking woman say terrible things about the military from the Japanese was meant to be demoralizing. So Tokyo Rose is a real person. She didn't call herself Tokyo Rose. Again, that was an allied thing. And so there is a variation of the theory. I mean, I've seen it in primarily Amelia Earhart Lives late in the, what was that, 1970s.
Sure, that Jervis book,
There
yes.
was kind of a subtle implication there that there was an implication in that book that George Putnam had heard a Tokyo Rose broadcast and said, "That voice sounds a little bit like my wife." That really is the end of the quote unquote evidence of it. But again, it's the thing about the Japanese capture theory is that I know that there are people who disagree with this, but that a lot of it, especially in the early years, is about taking these disparate pieces of information and putting them together in ways that quote unquote make sense. And the truth
Right.
about life is that life does not make sense sometimes. And so for people who believed that Amelia Earhart was captured by the Japanese or was somehow in Japan, which is some versions of the theory, well, of course, she spoke English, she was on the radio, she did radio broadcasts, of course she was Tokyo Rose. So it's one that, again, doesn't have a lot of evidence behind it, but also doesn't show up a lot in my research in the literature as well.
The Tokyo Rose thing is interesting because we, as you just mentioned, we have no transcripts, we have no recordings that ever surface.
No.
This is kind of an interesting way, I guess, into this, but if the government is engaged in any kind of conspiratorial agenda, when evidence for these things just doesn't seem to materialize or like it meets an unfortunate fate, we'll get to Wallach in a minute. Does the government get away with one here?
Well, sure. Yeah, and let's be honest. I mean, conspiracies exist. You know, there's a film called Conspiracy about the Nazi era, you know, era at the time. And to be fair, the government was doing things about the atomic bomb and keeping that. So there certainly were conspiracies and things the government were keeping secret. I mean, certainly, if that was the case, that the government had this massive plan or that they were covering something up about Amelia Earhart, I suppose in that argument they would have won. But I mean, I always fall back on Occam's razor here of and people tend to say that Occam's razor is this is means the simplest explanation is most likely the truth. It's actually a little bit different. What it really means is that the answer that requires the fewest assumptions is more likely to be true.
Well, this might have happened, and this might have happened, and this might have happened.
Exactly. And so to say, okay, there was a government conspiracy, you have to say, okay, I assume this, 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 and this. Whereas for me, I mean, to go back to the heart of it, it doesn't require that many assumptions to say something happened to the plane and it crashed. These theories require a lot more assumptions than that.
Sometimes it's black and white. Not in this case, but sometimes it is.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not, you know.
There's a lot of gray area, certainly, in the Earhart case. Okay, and really, the Wallach briefcase is another story that just, if it's true, it's a hell of a stroke of luck for him. For those that don't know, I'll give you the short version. Wallach is part of the military eyewitness testimony for Japanese capture. I love his story. I was gonna be a rich Marine. I love that whole story. But his unit basically comes across this briefcase in this abandoned building. They're sort of casing buildings post battle. It's in this safe. They blow the doors off of it, and there's a briefcase in there. And everything in it is dry as a bone, and it's full of Earhart's passports and her personal papers and things. And he does the right thing. He goes and he finds an officer that's got the scrambled eggs on their uniform, and the officer gives it to the officer, and the officer says, "Okay, here you go." And the officer actually gives him a, he actually writes him a fucking receipt that says Amelia Earhart's passports and papers in it, and he tucks it into his money belt. You fast forward a little bit, and he's in combat, and he gets injured, and they have to cut off his uniform so they can tend to his injury. And he's telling them, save the money belt. And of course, they don't save the money belt. And so it's gone. So we have no record. And of course, he never hears anything back from his superiors about it when he asks about it. You add stories like that to no transcripts, no audio recordings for Tokyo Rose, and people will argue with me on this, but you have stories. We'll get to the Jesuit dog photo in a bit.
No, yes, we shall.
We've newly reformed the Amelia Earhart Society, by the
Interesting.
way. So that's I've kind of reformed that. We've got a small group of folks. But I asked Les Kinney this in that conversation. There's another gentleman. He's a good friend of mine. His name is Sean Keats. Shout out to Sean Keats. We talked about Dick Spink's physical parts that he found on Milly Atoll that he matched to an Electra, a like Electra. But my question overall is, you have the briefcase that just slips through the fingers. You have no evidence of Tokyo Rose. It's all these things just sort of fall short. Does this theory just have like a major physical evidence problem? I mean, isn't that not a very obvious thing?
Yeah, I mean it very much does. And I'm, you know, more of an expert in the Japanese capture, but if you do lean more to the Castaway, the Gardner, Nikumaro Island, whichever island we're talking about at the moment, you know, there's circumstantial items that you can claim might be related, but there is a very limited amount, if really anything. I mean, there's certainly things that are weird. The briefcase, yeah, I mean, there's no record of it. It's weird. There were messages in a bottle we could talk about that were supposedly found around 1940 with messages from her. That's weird. But I would say two things. Number one, yes, there is a lack of physical evidence. And number two, it's a lot to jump from, oh, this thing is weird, to, oh my goodness, there's a conspiracy, and she, you know, it's a big jump. And I just keep going back to, I know where this theory came from. You know, I know the culture in which it arose. I know why it happened in 1941, 42 rather than 37. And so for this theory to be true, both of those things would have to be true at the same time. You know what I mean? That it would have to be a theory that arose because of World War II era propaganda, and that it was also true. Like those are two things that are really hard for me to thread together. And so, yes, I know a lot of theorists will disagree with me and say that there is supposedly evidence, but the evidence, quote unquote, I think is very thin.
Well, the Jaluit dock photo that is the centerpiece of the lost evidence.
Yes.
I still remember where I was at when that lost, and we were actually out shooting the documentary out in like the Pacific Northwest somewhere. And I remember the episode drops, and I remember it blows, up all these ratings, and it's the highest rated show on cable. And I remember 48 hours later, this Japanese blogger pops up on Twitter, at the time Twitter, now X, and says,
Not
"Hey,
still
that
Twitter.
photo." Yeah, right. That photo you found, that was a centerpiece of your whole thing. It was 1935. It was 2 years before, they could have ever physically been there. Now, to the credit of the folks that are arguing that it is Earhart and Noonan in the photo, they are still pursuing leads. They are still working, on that photo and trying to determine absolutely if that is the case or not. The photo still has a lot of believers out there. What are your thoughts on the Jaluit dock photo?
So I mean, in many ways, it doesn't surprise me. You know, I briefly mentioned the concept of confirmation bias. And look, we're all on the internet. Most of us know what this is, and that we tend to grab onto and believe evidence that exists with our pre-existing beliefs. Again, that goes back to the propaganda era. People are afraid of the Japanese. They see them in a certain way. Of course, they kidnapped Amelia Earhart. So when that's the case, it's very hard to give up that evidence, quote unquote, once it's been adopted. So I would say that's one element. I would say the other element, though, is the lost evidence. That documentary, number one, it is almost impossible to find on the internet today. It is very difficult. They pulled it from everywhere. Despite that, as you said, it got massive viewership during the about 48 hours when it was available. And the problem with how information spreads on the internet is that there were so many people who watched that documentary or saw a news story about it or saw something on social media. They were so much less likely to have seen the correction. And that's the issue with this kind of thing, in that, yes, there's a group of people who still believe it because they're, you know, and they're doing the research, like you said, and they're dedicated to that photo. But then there's also your average person who watched the History Channel on a Sunday night, who saw this and was like, oh, that's weird, or saw the photo somewhere else and have had no interest or, I mean, look, we're weird. No one out there is Googling and trying to prove and disprove, no one else other than the small group of people prove or disprove Amelia Earhart stuff. You know, the millions of people who watched that didn't. And so it really doesn't surprise me that people are still holding on to it because, number one, if it was real, it's great evidence. And number two, you have to actually actively look to correct things. And people don't do that. We tend to absorb media passively. And that is how this kind of information spreads, correct or incorrect.
Yeah, that's a hell of a point. I want to discuss the idea of suppression by design because Japanese capture requires one to believe, to a certain extent, that our government, and perhaps the Japanese government, conspired to at least partially cover, events, details, specifics of a potential spy theory, however you want to build that. Now, some people might argue, well, that's all part of the plan. I guess my question is, would suppression even be necessary if capture were real? Like, it couldn't be contained forever, right? If that actually happened.
I would say the odds are very strong that it would be difficult to contain it for a long period of time. I would also say if Amelia Earhart was captured by the Japanese in 1937, and let's say the US government found out about this during the war, 37, 38, 40, any of those years, you don't think they would have used that for propaganda purposes? Oh my God, that would have been used more than you could even possibly imagine. But then there's the question of coming up later. It's interesting because, you know, look, we don't know what we don't know. Are there government secrets of any about anything that haven't come to light? Sure. I'm sure that that's the case. But I also think the thing about the, hey, the government is in on it, the government is covering things up issue is, number one, there have been times, you know, to be fair, there have been times where the government has done things and has tried to cover it up, you know, Tuskegee experiments, for example. But again, we know about that because it came out. And being able to conceal a conspiracy that large between two different governments of a very well-known figure
That were at war with each other at the time.
who had war with each other, exactly, would be extraordinarily difficult. And
Right.
on top of that, I mean, we think that, oh, this might have been just five people in a room who are covering this up. You know, it's the State Department, it's whatever. But here's the thing: governments are a bureaucracy. It's never just one person, it's never just two person. There would have to be multiple people who knew about this, and for all of them to remain silent, to not leave letters behind for their kids.
It's a big ask.
Again, I go back to the Occam's razor theory of like, that's a lot of assumptions to make. I mean, again, can't prove a negative. Is it theoretically possible? Sure. I just think my argument on all of this is that it's very, very unlikely.
Well, okay. Well, so here's my position on this whole thing, and I'll ask you to weigh in. Look, I think if Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan were indeed ever in Japanese custody and they died in custody, they are heroes. It's a whole other ball game if that's the case. Prior to World War II, if that's what happened, everyone, and I do mean everyone, should be sort of outraged by that, if that's how her story ended. So I 100% support any and all efforts into any angle, that could prove the theory true because of all of them. I think the story should be fully told if it's determined to be what happened. Having said that, though, the issue that I have always had with this, and we've talked about this a lot, I'm kind of beating a dead horse here, maybe, but there just isn't any physical evidence to show that she was definitely there. Period. For all the opinions, as you mentioned, that people may have about Castaway, there's something quantifiable. Like you can look at that, and it's maybe circumstantial, depending on whether or not you believe Rick Gillespie or whether or not you believe something else entirely. But here, we've got stories. We have a lot of them. Over 200 eyewitnesses. That was my question I brought to Jen Taylor when we first had vanished. If I have 200 eyewitnesses that say they saw Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, like, is that enough? Is that a slam dunk? That was really the catalyst for that entire series. It's my favorite theory in the whole case because it's got so many implications, if it's true. And it contains so much of the Earhart mystery and the lore. But at what point do we say that lore is legitimate and we can like take that to the bank with no evidence, only testimony? And then when you look at the testimony, it turns out that, well, something doesn't add up there as well, as we'll get into here in a moment. At what point do we sort of call this whole thing? I'll argue the exact opposite in a moment for the devil's advocate, for the fairness. But am I missing something? Like, we have nothing.
I don't think that's the point. You know what I mean? Like, of course there's nothing. If I were someone else who believed this, I'd be giving you a whole list of evidence that I believe is evidence, you know? And so people believe this kind of theory because it serves a purpose. And for everyone, that's a different purpose. Look, Amelia Earhart's mother kind of dabbled a little bit in, ooh, I wonder if something happened.
That's
That
right.
served a purpose for her. Her daughter died in some mysterious way. Of course she wanted to believe that maybe she was alive somewhere. And it's different for everyone. So I can't speak to what purpose it serves for a lot of people, but whether it's attention or whether it's just, hey, this is a mystery and I want to solve it, which is a completely legitimate purpose, it serves a purpose. We often are so unaware of how our own brains work and how our own emotions work. And as long as this theory continues to be part of certain people's identities and part of their beliefs, that is extraordinarily difficult to pull apart. You would have to re-examine everything about yourself or everything about your views. And people don't like doing that. I don't like doing that. None of us like doing that. We don't like re-examining our own views. So I think, you know, I mean, conspiracies last forever as long as there's still people who want to believe them.
So now here's the other side of that argument. Now, I'm going to preface this by saying that finding the plane obviously changes everything.
Oh, obviously. Yeah.
Right. But while we're in this state, if you step back and you take a look at this entire case, all the lore, all the theory, and all the work that's been done to sort of arrive at the end, it seems almost like inconceivable to me that all of this could be wrong, right? So it's either she runs out of fuel, crashes in the ocean, and all of this is just happenstance. Or the majority of the information in this case is actually pointing to maybe a revision of history of sorts.
I think from that position, look, I sympathize with that viewpoint because when you look at it that way of, oh my gosh, there's just so much evidence why this can't come from nowhere. Again, it's one of those things that quote unquote makes sense. You know, it fits with the patterns in our brain, but it's only if you look at it that way. So the way that I've approached this, and I've approached it as a historian, is, and to borrow something from the legal side, is all of this evidence is essentially fruit of the poisonous tree, in that all of this supposed evidence that comes up all comes back to a corrupt core. And what I mean by that is it's really going back to this theory became popular because it aligned with wartime propaganda aims of the federal government and the American people during the 1940s. Pretty straightforward. We should be naturally skeptical of anything that tries to prove that, because if you're trying to prove something that already is a little bit iffy, it becomes questionable. And then a lot of the so-called evidence, quote unquote, comes much later and is brought forward by people who already believe the theory. And so, you know, you have the confirmation bias, but then you have the motivated reasoning, and that our emotions really pull us to seek evidence that aligns with what we're doing. Again, I get it. You mentioned this, and we'll get to it, I'm sure, about the, oh my God, there's just so many eyewitnesses. There's no way this couldn't be true. But then when you look at it, and you look at it a different way, just because there's a lot of information doesn't mean there's data there. You know, one of my favorite phrases is the plural of anecdote is not data. Yeah, you could have five different people who tell me something. Doesn't mean that it's data and doesn't mean that it's true. It just means that five different people have told me the same thing. And I think that there's something to that effect on a macro scale here.
What do you think Gerner's overall effect on this theory is? I mean, he blows the theory up. I mean, he's still got the only New York Times best-selling book on Amelia Earhart. Talking about people that maybe already believe the theory, the Marshallese, people like that, they're kind of locals. It's baked into their culture. They get stamps for it and everything. This is a guy who's out in Northern California, this news reporter. What do you think his impact is on, I guess, the sensationalism of the theory and the propaganda maybe side of the theory when it comes to the whole thing?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And Will, I won't get there yet, but there's an interesting dynamic between the Gerner and the Paul Briand of it all. Because Briand kind of comes a little bit earlier with the same
He
idea, but
does.
Gerner's the one who popularizes
He
it, you know,
does.
because
You're right.
he's the guy that had the platform.
That's
That's the
right.
truth of it. He's a
That's
good news
right.
reporter. He had the platform. You know, so the way that I've kind of divided this is that really there's three eras of the Japanese capture theory. There's the first one, which takes place during the Second World War, and then there's the second one. The third one is really the late 80s, early 90s, when it comes to the solidification of the Earhart stuff in Atchison, Kansas, and the coming of the internet. But the second phase starts with Gerner. It starts in 1960. It starts with the New York Times best-selling variation of this, which of course was settled on one particular eyewitness statement that we'll get to. I mean, I think he had a dramatic effect. I think we probably would not be talking about it if he had not popularized it in such a way.
Agreed.
And I mean, like, look, to his credit, he approached it as a reporter. You know, I don't think he's a bad writer. I don't think he's a bad reporter. I think he was just misled.
No, it's an excellent book.
Yeah, it's not a bad book. I do actually think he kind of disproves himself in his own book at some cases, which I think is interesting, which is a whole other thing. But I don't think we would be here talking about it if he had not stumbled upon that story in a small town newspaper in California, which is really where it came from, which was taken from, you know, I keep going. I'm not a huge fan of Paul Briand myself, and I know I'm going on a little bit of a rant here, just because of I've read his letters, and some of the ways he talks to Josephine Akiyama is a little questionable, and it makes, you know, makes me feel bad for her. But to his credit, he got the story first, but the Gerner was the one who popularized it. So yeah, I mean, he has a dramatic impact on this.
We started talking about Flight for Freedom, and I know Flight for Freedom is obviously it's a big part of your thesis and a big part of sort of maybe the catalyst for all of this. Do you want to myth bust this? Is there any truth to the idea that George Putnam actually ghost wrote the script for Flight for Freedom or had oversight? Because you hear that, and we like to try to, bust a few myths on the show if we can. So have you heard of that, and what are your thoughts on it?
I have heard of that. I have seen very little evidence that that is true. Now, what I will say, and I'm going to kind of disagree with myself here, is we also remember that George Putnam was a PR executive extraordinaire
Amazing.
and very good at it.
Very good at it. Yes.
Extremely, as a PR person myself,
Yes,
I
right.
value his initial work. You know, I would say that's one of those things that, number one, I think there's again, not really evidence of it. I also think that he probably would have claimed credit for it.
Probably.
Again, I'm making an assumption there. And honestly, even if he had written it, I still don't see how it would change the case.
So there's one specific area when it comes to, because there's so many eyewitnesses, and I'd rather than go through them all. I mean, if you want to hear that, we kind of did that on Vanish. Jen walked Rob Ellis through Thomas Devine and a lot of that, and walked through, a lot of the eyewitnesses there. A lot of the folks that support Japanese capture really put a lot of weight into the military eyewitness testimony, Julius Neighbors, Robert Wallach, those folks. What do you make of that? The Rich Martini videos. I mean, I've watched them so many times of those interviews, those original interviews of those folks who claimed that she was there, who witnessed her there, witnessed the aircraft there in specifics, or maybe who, took part in digging up graves or burying people or whatever the case was. I mean, what do you think of the military side of the eyewitness testimony for Japanese capture specifically?
It's interesting to be sure, obviously, to be fair, if this theory was correct, you would theoretically have members of the military coming forward saying that they had seen something. I keep going back to, and I know, and I'm sure you've talked about this, is eyewitness statements are really a low form of evidence. Even if they're coming from someone who theoretically would have been in the area and would have had knowledge and access, I go back to, yeah, five people could tell me something, it doesn't mean that it's true. And so, while I respect the position that they were in, they're just as, those eyewitness statements are just as affected by the psychological and cognitive and cultural forces that encourage the Japanese capture. The desire to find her, to be the one to find her, to find an answer to this mystery. We could dive into this more specifically, but the thing about eyewitness statements is that once one comes out, you have something called suggestibility bias, and that, once you plant the idea in someone's
Spreads like
head,
wildfire.
then of course everyone has heard it. Everyone has their own experience. I had an incident. I do actually think this is real. So this is an Atchison, Kansas story. This is completely separate, but I promise it's relevant. I think I was in middle school or high school. There was a rumor, and I do think there are places where this actually happened. There was a rumor that the US government had let pumas loose, like mountain lions, in Kansas to cull the deer population. And so suddenly my mother said, I saw something outside. And look, it might have been a bobcat. I don't know. It had a big head. At the same time, that was how she described it. At the same time, one of my neighbor's dogs was killed by some wild animal, which, by the way, in Atchison happens a lot when you live in the country. And then suddenly my neighbors were like, I saw something. I saw something. Look, could there have theoretically been a large cat in the woods? Maybe. I remember as a kid being like, wow, that would be really cool, and wanting to believe it. So that there's a similar dynamic here of once one eyewitness comes forward, then you have copycats and you have people who completely unintentionally, a lot of this is subconscious. And that's what I want to push here is that the thing about this theory and people who come forward claiming certain things is that most of the time they're not people who have intentions and really negative and want to lie and stir things up. I think there's a lot of people who hear the suggestion elsewhere and then make connections in their head and say, oh, you know what? This is what I found. I think those are just affected by the forces as anything else.
Well, listen, we've talked a lot tonight about how this theory began. Why does the theory stay so relevant? 2025. I know it's because we don't have a period on the end of the sentence. I'm aware of that. That's like the elephant in the room. Well, we don't know. So, of course, it's always going to be out there until we know. Why do you think it continues? I mean, it's still white hot. It's still white hot. What do you think sustains that?
It is. So I would say a couple of things. I know you already mentioned it, but the fact that it's unknown is such a foundational part of the theorizing. I would say also number two, it's a fun theory, right? Like there's
It really
something
is.
very fulfilling about it. And I'll go back to Amelia Earhart's mother gave an interview to a newspaper, and she says something to the extent of, someone so wonderful as her, someone so beautiful and wonderful and talented, couldn't have just disappeared in a normal, kind of plane crash. There was no way. People like the equivalency. Someone like Amelia Earhart couldn't have been struck down that way, that it had to be something dramatic. It had to be governments coming after her because it's much more satisfying, right? It's the same thing with, and this actually is along the same, right? It's the same thing with JFK. Like there's something unsatisfying of it being a lone gunman in a book depository. Of course, there was someone on the grassy knoll. There was a second shooter. It was the communists. It was the mob. It was all these people. There's the satisfying aspect to it is that it's fun and it's interesting. But then I will also say practically as a historian, because we hinted about this a little bit when we talked about Garner, in that there are almost watershed moments in the history. It's not just, this theory came up and then now, oh, it still exists. Like there are, and I know you know this, but there are incidents within the history of this theory that bring it back. There's Garner in the 60s, and there's a bunch of subsequent books. And I'm sure, as you know, most of the books and publications, with a few rare exceptions, until about 1989, were written by male authors and written about her disappearance. You don't see a lot of biographies. You don't don't see a lot written about by women. Now, some of that is the time. Let's be fair. So you see that uptick in publications after the 60s and 70s, and then, it kind of continues, fades. But then you see the efforts of the original Amelia Earhart Society and the integration of that theory with the early birthplace museum. And then you have the internet. I mean, the truth of it, it's something that's interesting to talk about. You see another uptick in 2017 with the History Channel documentary. So I think it's not that it's remained consistent, it's always here. It's just it's had these spikes that have kept it alive for decades and decades.
I'm Googling as you're talking about that, because I do want to ask about something that's sort of, I guess, outside the Japanese capture, obviously outside the Japanese capture theory, but it certainly in it could be included in sort of identification of misinformation in the Amelia Earhart story. Lori Gwynne Shapiro has a book coming out, Aviator and the Showman, Amelia Earhart, George Putnam, and the Marriage That Made an American Icon. And in that book, I think a lot of the promo is really sort of gearing toward the idea that there are going to be revelations in that book that might target some of Earhart's legacy, maybe specifically her writing or something else of that nature. The whole misinformation thing I know spreads rampant throughout the disappearance side of things. But if you step back and look at her life, it almost runs as rampant through her life as it does, her death and her disappearance and the fallout around all of that. I don't know. She seems like such a polarizing figure. I mean, is that fair to, I guess, to make that statement?
Polarizing doesn't feel like the right word to me, and not because it's not true. There's certainly people that dislike her. There's people who believe that she's overrated. There's people who still believe that she was a bad pilot. There's all these different kinds of things. But I would say a couple things. Number one, just for me personally, and I'll go into the historian side, but with the Amy side of things, not the historian brain, the one thing that made me fall in love with her story as a historian as I was doing this research is actually not, she was amazingly accomplished and we should recognize that, but also how relatable she was. One of the most profound things I found, and I'll have to, I posted it on social, I have to go back and look at it, but she gave this speech that was transcribed in a newspaper article. And she's clearly joking, but any woman who hears this hears something different. And she says something like, when I was a kid, I looked in the mirror and I noticed that I wasn't as beautiful as the other woman, that my eyes were in a different place, my nose was too big, all these kind of things. And I would never be a beauty queen, so I decided to fly, or something to that extent.
Shit.
You just hear the insecurity in her that to me was so relatable. Let me put my historian hat back on. So in the history of history, which we call historiography, there's different ways of looking at it. And for the longest period of time, primarily, and this was very, very big still in the 19th and 20th centuries, we followed what we call the great man theory of history. And man was pretty specific there. It mostly was men. But it's a belief that the world has changed and progress moves by the actions of a few really powerful, important people. And so you see, like in American history, you see the focus on the founders and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And it's not that those aren't important people, but progress happens a little bit differently. And so you see this with Amelia Earhart as well. And I see this very specifically in Holocaust history. We tend to put rescuers. Look, I'm also an expert on the Holocaust rescuer, Karl Lutz, no relation that I'm aware of. So I see this in a different path, is that we tend to put heroes, whether they're Holocaust rescuers or whether they're Amelia Earhart, on podiums or on podiums, but on pedestals. We build them up to a point that they can't even reach themselves. And so when you dive into the reality of them, who they really were, it seems disappointing because we've built them up into something that they're not. And so I think a lot of that really is just an indictment on how we perceive history and how we have, in some cases, blown up the history of some of these figures. When I think, in actuality, looking at who they are as people, their flaws, their successes as well, is so much more interesting and so much more relatable. So I think that has so much more to do with just how it's been done. And I think, Lori Gwynne Shapiro clearly has spent a lot of time really diving into who this woman was, what her marriage was. So I think it's just a natural process of how history has shifted.
Well, the mystery side of this has now become so big that I'm starting to worry about it overshadowing her legacy a little bit. Do you think that's what's happening here, or is the legacy, in your opinion, strong enough to contain the mystery, so to speak?
That's such a great point, because this was something I kept coming up and up again in my thesis, I had actually had to ask myself, am I complicit in the erasing of Amelia Earhart's legacy? Because I'm talking about her disappearance. Like that was really what I focused on. And again, things go in phases. I think for the longest time, after she disappeared, I do think her voice shrunk. I think, Amelia Earhart was very small and the mythology around her was very big. And so much of it was about things that she literally probably was not alive to know about, things that happened after she died. Her biography and her narrative was being written by other people who had different motivations. Now, that being said, I think to the credit of a lot of biographers, interested parties of, and I'll give credit to some institutions in Atchison, Kansas, the Amelia Earhart Festival, the Amelia Earhart Foundation, the Hanger Museum. I think especially in the last 30 years, her voice really has come back into the forefront. There's been a lot more effort to recenter her in the narrative. I mean, the movie with Hilary Swank, which is a fine movie, but it doesn't really dive into it. It doesn't dive
No,
into the
it's
theory.
surface
It
level.
talks about who she is. I think her narrative is coming back to the forefront. Again, that's luckily just because of a lot of different forces, because of how we look at things differently, but that's never going to drown out the theories and the conspiracy side of things, because honestly, it's too interesting. Look, I used to love to watch documentaries on like Bigfoot and stuff. It's interesting. It's just so much more interesting than real life. You know what I mean? Real life is sometimes boring.
Sometimes. Well, if I don't ask you about Irene Bolam, I will be crucified by my listeners of the show. So we will throw the Bolam thing into the well, we'll throw the Bolam hat into the ring here, I should say. The idea of repatriation, and the idea that she came back, and that, she was smuggled out of Japanese custody by Jackie Cochran potentially, and all of these really, fantastical ideas, and the idea that obviously the whole, Earhart is Bolam, Bolam is Earhart kind of thing. We know that part of the theory. There's a lot of theory going around lately, or in the last, 7 to 10 years potentially, that maybe Bolam and Earhart knew each other. We do know that they knew each other. We have, 99's photos of them together, so we know that, that was true. That part at least was true. What do you think of the whole Bolam idea, the way it played out? I know we mentioned Amelia Earhart lives. There will be a link to that in the show's notes. What do you think about that whole side of it? The idea that she was repatriated. Is that just an extension of wanting her story to be more romantic than history writes?
I think so. I mean, it all, and I hate to keep repeating myself. I would say the Irene Bolam theory is one of my favorites because
It's me too.
it's just so out there. It's very clear to me that when you, I mean, I've read the book. I've despite the fact that it was pulled from shelves shortly after it was released, I have read the book.
Hi, I'm a red flag. How are you? Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And there's your red flag right there. It's like a court of law, knew enough to do that. But what's really interesting when you read the book is it's very clear because it's stated in the book that the mere fact that she looked like Amelia Earhart was the basis upon this theory rested, and then all of the other evidence was built around it. I mean, there's the whole weird part about the Phoenix Island system where the authors took a single letter from each island and then it spelled Irene Bolam's husband's name. Like, what is that?
God, I love it though. Please be true. Please be true.
But here's the thing, at the heart of it, and I want to be like sympathetic here, at the heart of it, a lot of that is a desire for Amelia Earhart to still be alive. If Irene Bolam was Amelia Earhart, she'd still be alive. Wouldn't that be great?
It's a very human thing.
It's easier for me to like tear these things down, but they're really centered in this genuine, I think, desire for, yes, things to make sense and for us to reduce unknowns because our brains don't like that. But also, we don't want her story to end that way. Wouldn't that be an interesting end to her story? That she came back and she was smuggled back. And again, a bunch of people knew about it and no one ever said anything. I think it's just such an interesting aspect of it. But again, it's grown out of, I mean, number one, the theory was rampant by that time, the broader Japanese capture theory. So it didn't come out of nowhere. It was really coming from stuff that had already existed. But yeah, I mean, it's just another variation. And I also think it may have been a little bit of the author's determination to separate themselves from other strands of the theory. Because, everyone wants their special thing, right? I mean, this is true. And anytime you published a book or anything, you want to have your own pitch. And so no one was going to go out and write Fred Gerner's book again because he already wrote it.
It's already done.
He needed another train. And Irene Bolam was that theory. And unfortunately, it still exists in some pockets,
It sure
but
does. It sure
it
does.
really does not have much evidence to back it up.
All right. Final question of this night. And I've asked it several times on the show, but for you, I think I'm going to frame it a little bit differently. When it comes to her legacy, and the seemingly very important role that the mystery plays in this whole thing. Do you think anything would be lost by arriving at a finality and finally knowing the answers?
Interesting. What a good question. I think the truth of the matter is that the answer is maybe. I hate to say that because it's somewhat counter to everything I've said, but as much as it bothers me, as much as I think Amelia Earhart's voice is lost in all of this narrative, it is her mysterious disappearance that in many ways has kept her story alive. You know, we see, again, let me do a weird side train here. For those who understand Holocaust history, there was a Holocaust rescuer by the name of Raoul Wallenberg. And Raoul Wallenberg was active in Budapest, Hungary. He was from Sweden. He received funding from the US government. And he was an incredible rescuer, but by far did not rescue as many as his Swiss partner, Karl Lutz, who was active in Budapest at the same time. But despite that, we remember Raoul Wallenberg. And it's weird because he comes up actually in some of the books when I read about Wallenberg and Earhart, because he was, you know, we didn't find out what happened to him until 89 when the wall fell. But he was arrested by the Soviets and disappeared. And for decades and decades and decades, no one knew what happened to him. So in Holocaust history in the United States, he is an immense figure. The most recent Star Trek iteration had a ship named after Wallenberg. And in all the reports that it got the numbers of people he saved wrong, and it really bothered me. But the reason I bring that up is because it's just another example of when people meet a mysterious end, that does help keep the story alive. Now, what I hope is that the efforts made by a lot of institutions, a lot of individuals to share her story will, you know, let's say we find the plane tomorrow and it's somewhere, you know, it's on an island, it's in the ocean, who knows? We find a definitive end. Her story will survive because there are people invested in it surviving, but I do think it might not have the same buzz to it. And I want to say
Good
that
point.
despite that, it's up to the rest of us who have, and again, institutions and individuals who have an interest in her story to keep it alive, to tell her story, to make sure people find it. But because I don't think we're going to find out what happened to her anytime soon, and even if we do, there will still be people probably who think, even if we find the plane, that it was moved or it's not the plane, I think it's going to have a long shelf life.
Well, Amy, I was looking forward to this for a while, and you didn't disappoint. Thank you
Oh,
so
thank
much.
you.
I really appreciate it. I think listeners are going to just eat this up
I hope so.
completely, because this is the kind of stuff that people really enjoy, these kinds of conversations. So thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was great.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/chasingearhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @chasingearhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.